Chicago Public Radio. This is Odyssey. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Scientists are highly trained professionals. In order to do their work, they must possess highly specialized and complicated knowledge. Scientific training takes place at prestigious universities and requires years to complete. This sort of preparation suggests that science is no place for amateurs. But mainstream or high science has long had a more popular cousin. In this other world of science, people follow the latest developments, read about scientific issues and questions, and in many cases, do a little experimenting or observing themselves. So, is there a relationship between mainstream science and the amateur practitioners? Are the amateurs fans of science, or have they also been its critics? Has the backyard scientist helped to determine the cultural authority of scientific knowledge? Today on Odyssey, we're going to explore the relationship of amateur scientists to mainstream scientific inquiry. Joining us for the conversation is Eric Drown. He's an American Studies scholar, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. Hello, Eric Drown. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. With us in Eugene, Oregon, is historian of science Paul Farber. Hello, Paul Farber. Thank you very much for being on the program.
Morning. Nice to be here.
Paul Farber, let me ask you to begin. When does science become the domain of professionals?
Yeah, well, of course, science is not monolithic, so it changed to, depending on disciplines. But as a generalization, you could say that in the early 19th century, science becomes professional. Before then, scientists wrote for the general public. They weren't paid. You could pick up an 18th century science book today and take it with you on the plane and read it for fun.
And understand it?
And understand it.
And so what happens? I mean, what is that process of professionalization?
Well, a lot of it has to do with money. 19th century saw a huge change in Western culture, the Industrial Revolution. So it made opportunities available for people who formerly would have had to do their science on the side. They would have had a day job. But people working full-time then found themselves speaking to other full-time professionals, defining what were the leading cutting-edge problems, and becoming very specialized.
And so does that process mean that there are people left behind? Are there amateur scientists who might have continued but for the transformations of science as a practice?
Yeah, very much. I mean, someone in the 18th century is writing for general public. Someone in, say, 1850, 1870, in natural history is writing for the other 200 people who are interested in Venezuelan parrots. So the amateurs really get squeezed out.
Eric Drown, what sorts of responses do we see? I mean, do people who are still interested in science but not doing it professionally come up with some other practice?
Yes, in fact, they do. And it's not only that they come up with alternative sets of practices, that after the professionalization of science, lots of other kinds of people begin to take up the practice. So I think you could sort of say that gentlemen amateurs continue for a long time doing what they've been doing. But at the turn of the 20th century and on into the 1920s, a whole new class of people come into the practice of amateur science. These are working class people who are really experiencing their science through the lens of consumer technologies like radio. Ham radio enthusiasts buy a piece of crystal and they wrap some copper wire around a oatmeal box and they take a hat pin and make a cat whisker out of it and they begin to see if whether or not they can get Albuquerque from Chicago on AM radio.
Okay, I don't mean it's not like a dope, but what's a cat whisker?
A cat whisker is a little piece of wire that you use to alter the magnetic field that's created by the interrelationship of the magnetic field of the crystal and the copper wire by sort of just waving it around.
Okay, so these amateurs, when you say, you started out by saying they were working class people, would these be people who had no expectation of ever becoming professional scientists, who would have seen themselves as excluded from the high practice of science?
From the highest levels, the first professional scientists in America were largely the sons of middle-class families and the working-class people who were among the largest group of people participating in ham radio, really thought of themselves as not being able to afford the college education that was the prerequisite of those best jobs. So if they were going to aspire to scientific careers, as many of them did, they would have to gain the education necessary through correspondence school, through self-study, those kind of things.
Well, Paul Farber, is this an indication that this new kind of science is still very popular? I mean, if people are finding ways to participate, even if they're not in the mainstream or at the cutting edge, can we read that as science having a great sort of hold on the popular imagination?
Well, sure. But there's been an increasing distance between the professional and the amateur. So that they live in separate worlds, and a lot of the problems that they're interested in are completely different. So you almost wonder whether you want to continue to talk about the science. I mean, it is science, of course. It's a study of nature. But they're at great removes.
What do you mean when you say that the problems they're interested are different? Can you give me an example?
Well, I mean, someone interested in astrophysics in the university is interested in some very technical mathematical problems. An amateur might be interested in following what's happening on with the Mars rover. So just qualitative observational as opposed to quantitative mathematical technical problems.
We're talking today on the program about the relationship between amateur scientists and mainstream science and the ways in which amateurs may have shaped science as a discipline and as a set of practices. Eric Drown, do you find that amateurs are interested in different questions from professionals?
Mostly, yes, largely because of their sets of interest in science. I think Paul Farber really hit it on the head when he said that many amateurs aren't really doing science for the purpose of doing science. They're really doing it to become a member of a subculture, to find a way to create the world that they wish they could live in, but is not being realized in the social world outside their experience. So I think these groups of people are interested in questions of science. They really want to invent, they really want to create something new, but they also want a little profit from their effort and also some social prestige that's associated with that. Ironically, these desires are often the very same desires of professional scientists and engineers who in the teens and 20s really set a claim for themselves for cultural authority based on the premise of being the embodiment of classic Republican values.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think about the kind of groups who were being professionalized between sort of 1880 and 1920, you have, of course, doctors, lawyers, and ministers who'd been professional for a long time, but scientists, engineers, teachers, and social workers all became professionals in the period I mentioned. And by the 1920s, plumbers, undertakers, and garbage men were all claiming to be professionals. So when you have people from all of these occupational ranges claiming to be professional, it must be because the professional embodies certain ideals. So classic Republican values like freedom, being a self-made man, being able to determine one's future, having self-governance. These are all elements of a professional practice in science. And they're paradoxically exactly the same values that the amateurs want to promote among themselves. So ham radio operators, for example, claim that even though they want a little bit of profit, they're really motivated by contributing to humanity. That unlike Navy radio operators who are compelled to behave in a certain way, they get to do really whatever they want, including interfering with naval operations. So a whole number of things emerge as a constellation of values that's being negotiated between professionals and amateurs in the period that I write on.
You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Our conversation today is about amateur scientists and their relationship with mainstream science. Paul Farber, let me come back to you because I'm wondering whether even earlier than this period, earlier than the turn of the 18th, 19th century, if science is making claims about its authority that are related to its association with expertise and with specialization. In other words, where does the professionalization of science fit in with this larger story of professionalization?
Well, I think when you look at science, in the earlier periods, the 17th, 18th century, science was part of high culture. So you have to think of it as similar to classical music and poetry. You know, a gentleman, a lady, was supposed to know something about this. And every gentleman in the 18th century would have a collection of, you know, stuffed birds and seashells and things like that. And the people who are writing, they're writing for this general high culture. That starts to change at the end of the 18th and beginning of the 19th century with the changes in the society, the industrial society, changing that whole world of the gentleman and the lady, sort of taking over the middle class. And one of the main driving forces that changes science is specialization. And that had to do with the European countries being colonial powers, exploring, bringing back hundreds of thousands of specimens. The work then becomes highly, highly specialized in museums. And the average person sitting around the table after dinner doesn't want to talk about that. It's too specialized. It's not interesting. So that you get the separation of the specialist from the general public increasingly through the late 18th, early 19th century.
So it sounds like two things are going on. You've got at least two things, probably a bunch more, but yeah. At least two things. You have an increase in the complexity and mm-hmm. volume of scientific information so that you have to have people specializing in order to just manage all the knowledge. But then you have changes in the economic system, the class system, that means that different people do different kinds of work and are participating in different types of activities so that you get a professional scientist.
Yeah, exactly. And as Eric was mentioning, the professional scientist has to distance himself from all the other people to show that he's a professional or she's a professional. And that's by writing in about jargon, at least in a form that the average person just can't pick up and read. Becomes a code for other professionals to decipher.
So in other words, it isn't merely the case that the knowledge separates the professional from the amateur. There are other ways. That distinction becomes important to scientists themselves, and so they work to reinforce it?
Absolutely. You can read some fairly technical work done in the early 19th century, say in biology, it's in very good prose. Charles Darwin, for example, was a wonderful writer, and that's very accessible. But today, if you pick up Science Magazine, the average person picks up Science Magazine, you can't get two sentences into an article.
All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk some more about that distance between the amateur and the professional and what it means for science and its place in culture. We'll talk some more about amateur scientists and the way they have shaped science. Stay with us. I'm Gretchen Helfrich, and you're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. We'll be right back. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. We're talking today on the program about amateur scientists and the relationship they have had to mainstream science, whether they've helped to define science as a practice, as an undertaking. Our guests today are Eric Drown, who is a visiting professor in the American Studies Department at George Washington University. He is the author of the forthcoming book, Invention Culture, Reading Popular Science and Science Fiction in Modernist America. He's joining us from Washington, D.C. With us in Eugene, Oregon, is Paul Farber. He's a historian of science at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. He's the author of Finding Order in Nature, The Naturalist Tradition from Linnaeus to E.O. Wilson. He's also the author of Discovering Birds, The Emergence of Ornithology as a Scientific Discipline. Paul Farber, let me come back to this point you've been making about the distance between the specialized scientists and the amateurs. I got the sense from the way you were talking that you see that distance as a problem.
Oh, yeah. Problem for the general public and a problem for the scientists, because the gap between the practicing scientist and the general public has gotten larger and larger. It's hard to know how to bring it back together now. It's gotten so very far apart. The professionals, part of being a professional is to write for other professionals, not to write for the general audience, the general public. So someone like Stephen Jay Gould, beloved as he was by the general public, was severely criticized, looked down upon by a number of his colleagues in science departments.
For doing that popularizing work.
Yeah. So there's a real disincentive. So you don't get sort of the people who are most knowledgeable providing information for the general public. We have to depend on popularizers who are often very competent, but sometimes not.
Mm-hmm. Eric John, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, a couple of things, actually. The same thing happened to Isaac Asimov, who was actually a biochemist in Boston University's medical school, who couldn't win tenure. In part because the faculty didn't like him writing popular science. I would say a few things about the question of scientists' claims of broader cultural authority, and I think that one of the things you have to understand is by the late 19th century, science is becoming a master discourse. In other words, it's a way of conceptualizing not only how the natural world is configured, but how the social world is configured. So science is being used to bring legitimacy to economists, political science, and also cultural studies in the form of anthropology and psychology and sociology and those kind of things, and scientists and other kinds of people using science, like engineers, like Frederick Taylor or Henry Gantt, are trying to use the authority of science to make claims about the reformation of the work process in particular. So Frederick Taylor says we need to have scientific ways of doing any particular kind of work, and all of that culture of the craftsman who has been doing this work for centuries and been doing it in his way and having the kind of autonomy that the skilled craftsman has is all being sacrificed to scientific efficiency. So over and over again in this period, we begin to see science being used to explain things not about scientific questions, but about societal questions. And that's why I think the distance that you're talking about between the professional and the amateurs really happen. It's because they're really not talking about the same things at all. Science, and popular science especially, becomes a kind of vernacular social theory, a way of explaining the emergence of new institutions and new social configurations.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because what I was wondering was whether, if there is this gap between the general public and scientific knowledge, it seemed like amateur scientists are good candidates to play a mediating role or a bridging role. People who take it upon themselves to try to understand science and, talk about it with their friends over dinner or what have you. But Paul Farber, I mean, do you see any of that happening? Eric Drown, I can tell you don't. I'll come back to that. But Paul Farber, I'd like your take on that.
Yeah, I see an increasing distance. And I agree with Eric completely that science is used to legitimate all sorts of positions, usually in a fairly... Well, in a way that is not valid, The science doesn't really legitimate it. It's just used to legitimate. And the general population doesn't have a very good handle on, sort of, to be snobby about, you know, real scientific knowledge, and can be pretty easily manipulated. So it all becomes a marketing issue. Just put the word science in, and it gives legitimacy to it.
Mm-hmm. To everything. I mean, you can go into a department store and see people talking about the scientific theory behind, you know, lipstick colors and how it's based on science. And so, Eric Drown, it seems pretty clear to me that you don't think that amateur scientists play this bridging role.
Well, you would really expect them to, given their kind of structural position. They tend to gather their science, however, not from the scientific journals. They read it in encyclopedias. They read it in popular redactions. And so that's why I really think that popular science isn't about science so much as it is about social theory. And let me give you a historical example. Most people think that the first generation of science fiction readers were either practicing scientists and children. And the reason why people think they're practicing scientists is that's what Hugo Gernsback told them. Hugo Gernsback was the editor of the first English language all science fiction magazine, Amazing Stories. And then people think it's written by children because they remember the pulp origins of science fiction. But my own work has revealed that the first readers of these magazines, first derived from the ham enthusiasts, and second were wage-earning people. So their connection to science really had little to do with an institutional affiliation or even the tradition of science or any of those kind of things. And it really was about carving out an enclave for themselves. They looked around the industrializing world, and especially, you know, given the economic uncertainties between 1900 and 1939, realized that a lot was out of their control. And even though science promised them a brilliant future and one that was secure, it was radically insecure for them. And so what they did is they substituted science fiction or popular science for the kind of industrial science that was being done by AT&T or General Electric or those kind of companies, which was sort of warmer and more human and enabled them to live at least temporarily for part of the week in a world of their own making.
So do you think that they're doing that by doing that, those people enhanced or reinforced some cultural authority for science, even if their version of science was different? Eric Drown?
Well, I guess I'm not so sure about that.
Actually, if I can cut in for a second, in some ways it undermines it. I mean, think about when a student, say, a young person is interested in popular science and, say, read science fiction and goes to school and signs up for a physics course. Suddenly, the physics looks very dull, very boring, very alienating. So in some ways, it almost acts to drive people away from science.
By giving them a false sense of what science is like or about?
Yeah.
Paul Farber is a historian of science at Oregon State University in Corvallis, Oregon. He's the author of Finding Order in Nature, The Naturalist Tradition, from Linnaeus to E.O. Wilson. He's also the author of Discovering Birds, The Emergence of Ornithology as a Scientific Discipline. We're talking today about the relationship of amateur scientists to professional science, and we're going to take some calls in a little while. Our number is 888-859-1800, 1-888-859-1800. The number's toll-free anywhere in the U.S., so give us a call if you'd like to join in the conversation. We're also talking today with Eric Drown, who is a visiting professor in American Studies at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He is at work on the forthcoming book, Invention Culture, Reading Popular Science and Science Fiction in Modernist America. Eric Drown, I'm wondering if the position of amateur scientist has also been a position from which to critique science. In other words, to say science has lost its moorings and isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing.
Yes, especially professional science as it was housed in corporate research laboratories, not so much in academic settings. Somebody like Albert Einstein, who was doing science with a slide rule and a piece of paper and a chalkboard, was one of their heroes. But industrial science seemed really, really dry to them. They feared that they would be trapped in a research lab doing boring routine work. And so in the science fiction culture, they did science that was much more explosive. And I think, you know, some of the first science fiction readers were involved in amateur rocketry that looks very much like some of the work that Robert Goddard was doing, and were involved in astronomy. But they were also doing things like trying to get usable electricity from trees. So, you know, the real crackpot element of it stood up. And that I see as a kind of like discursive critique. In other words, if you're trying to get electricity from trees, you really are not accepting the paradigms of science. Over and over again, readers of science fiction magazines said science had abandoned the big questions and were working with a closed book. And it was going to take men like, you know, Thomas Edison or Nikola Tesla or figures like that to reopen the doors of science and get the big project back on the agendas.
So in other words, science had become sort of co-opted, or it's almost like you're saying that they've scientists somehow sold out or got domesticated, right, and they want to be the sort of wild scientists.
Exactly. In exchange for a regular paycheck, you accept the organizational goals of companies whose first concern are profit, rather than trying to build a future that is fair or humane or wonderful or any of those kind of things.
Paul Farber, you know, we've been talking a lot today about the gap between professionals and amateurs, but are there also points of connection? Is there a role for amateur scientists in the conduct of professional scientific work?
Yeah, but not in all science. It's hard to imagine someone helping out in theoretical physics. But certainly in something like ornithology, the amateurs have never disappeared and continues to be very valuable. Part of it has to do with manpower. Audubon bird counts on Christmas Day. The Cornell Ornithology...
Wait, I don't know about the Audubon bird counts.
Well, it's an enormous effort that's taken throughout the country, where everyone, not everyone, but many, many, many people, mostly amateurs, go out and observe birds and see, you know, how many robins they can find in their neighborhood and different species, identify them. It gives a sense of what's out there nationwide at one point in time.
Huh.
Professionals can't do that. You need lots and lots of people with binoculars walking around. People who like to look at birds, who are interested and can identify them. Those are the amateurs. Cornell Ornithology Lab coordinates a great deal of work by amateurs across the country. And that's very, very valuable material.
But it's material of a particular kind. I mean, it sounds like you're talking about data collection or classification.
That's right.
Well, this actually takes me back to the story you were originally telling about specialization, because I'm wondering if the professionalization of science in any way coincides with a change in the kinds of knowledge that science was interested in. I mean, I think a lot of people know the story about classification as a sort of origin or original organizing idea for natural history, figuring out how things are related to other things and grouping things by type. And it sounds like, to some extent, that's the kind of work you're talking about amateur ornithologists doing. So is specialization related to some kind of change in the nature of scientific knowledge?
Well, I'm not sure. I think all of it is just specialization. But as people looking, instead of just saying, okay, you know, what's out there? Are there robins and blue jays and cardinals? As opposed to collectors at the end of the 19th century saying that we need to look at the sex organs of 3,000 insects in order to distinguish two species and look at it under the microscope. Very, very painstaking, complicated work. So it's still classification. But it's at a finer grain.
Okay.
Can I ask Paul Farber a question?
Sure. Let me jump in and give our number again, though. 1-888-859-1800. We are going to take some calls in a few minutes, so I want to make sure that listeners have that number. It's toll-free anywhere in the U.S., so give us a call and join our conversation about amateur scientists. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Eric Drown, go ahead.
Well, this is a question that's outside my realm of my expertise, but I'm wondering if in the 19th century, with the rise of professionalized models of specialization, whether or not questions of morals and values begin to drop out of, you know, natural history as it becomes science.
Oh, yes, absolutely. In the 18th century, early 19th century, people are very comfortable talking about what moral lessons we can derive from nature. That's part of what makes the readings so attractive and interesting to people. But that becomes an unprofessional question that drops out by the 20th century.
Right, and then when you get social Darwinism being wrapped up in the cloak of science again, it's one of the reasons why, although it's a persuasive political model, many, many scientists come out against it, I think.
Yeah,
it's a mix of categories.
Exactly, yeah. And today people, well, I mean, today, actually, in sociobiology, we have an odd kind of return of this. But it's very controversial. There are many scientists who think it's just terrible that people are confusing different domains.
But, Eric Drown, you were suggesting earlier that for amateur scientists, the moral component or the sort of normative component remains a strong one.
That's right. And that, I think, that's one of the reasons why, although, you know, we keep asking, what are the connections between, you know, I talk more about popular science than amateur science, I guess, but what's the connection between popular science and professional science? And that's why it's not there in the mind of professional scientists. You know, the popular scientists and the amateurs are making too many category errors. So how can you talk to these people? And in the minds of amateurs, the professionals are leaving too many of the most important questions unasked and uninvestigated. So how can you talk to those people?
Or the professionals are shirking their duty. They're pretending not to take responsibility for things they should be taking responsibility for.
For something like human cloning.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask Eric Drown. I mean, maybe the answer to this is obvious, but what do you mean when you say the big questions?
Well, the big questions about how are we going to achieve human justice? What are the origins of the universe in such ways that guide human behavior and those kind of things?
What's our responsibility to the ecosystem that we're trashing?
Right.
The meaning questions.
Right.
Okay, and those are questions that the amateurs, as you see them, are intensely interested in, though not the professional scientists.
Yes, but interested in them in an indirect and often metaphorical way. I think, for example, about debates that happened in the pages of Amazing Stories and Astounding Stories in the early 1930s about the existence of Atlantis or Mu. These are surely not scientific questions, so what were they questions about? I think they were really questions about what the golden age of humanity could look like, and if there was this ancient past far away that integrated science and religion and art and all those kind of things, why don't we live in such an age now? Our answer to that was Coney Island, a place where you could go experience the latest technologies and have fun. But, you know, where are the answers to the big questions at Coney Island?
Eric Drown, I got to stop you. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation and take some phone calls at 1-888-859-1800. You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio.
Thank you.
listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Today on the program, we've been talking about amateur science, amateur scientists, and the role they've played in shaping mainstream science, the relationship between amateur and professional science. Our guests are Eric Drown, visiting professor in the American Studies Department at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He's joining us from Washington. Eric Drown is working on a book called Invention Culture, Reading Popular Science and Science Fiction in Modernist America. From Eugene, Oregon, we are joined by Paul Farber, who is a historian of science at Oregon State University in Corvallis. Paul Farber is the author of Discovering Birds, The Emergence of Ornithology as a Scientific Discipline, and Finding Order in Nature, The Naturalist Tradition from Linnaeus to E.O. Wilson. Our number once again, 1-888-859-1800. Let's take a call. Let's talk with David. Hi, David. You're on Odyssey.
Hi.
Hi.
Great show. And I was actually, I was listening, you know, over the break and all that on the phone, and I noticed that that your guests have actually kind of brought this full circle back to the program from yesterday. Talking about the big questions.
We did a program yesterday on cloning.
Cloning, and is it right to use the scientific knowledge to clone human beings? So, but that was not my original idea for calling, because I told the producer that I have a an example to give.
Okay.
I used to own a Volkswagen Squareback. Now this was maybe 20 years ago or so, and I was living in Houston. And I could actually work on that car, you know? I mean, it was accessible to me in certain ways. I couldn't, like, I could not fabricate a Volkswagen in the backyard if you called on me to do that. But I could, like, work on it. The idea that I've had, like, just sort of looking around at my own life and in just life in general, is that we all are getting extremely specialized, and that there's really no chance it's a societal question. We all
not
have
just,
to work together.
Not just a question for science?
Well, I mean, science would then include everything. I mean, you know, where does science begin and where does science end, I guess, would be part of the question.
All right. Paul Farber, what's your any response to David's comments?
Well, I think the point's very good, because we've been talking about science, but in fact, science is embedded in the broader culture. And what we see generally in Western culture from the late 18th century to the present is a process of increased specialization in everything, medicine, education, music, art, science. Composers today compose classical music for other composers. It's hard to listen to a lot of contemporary music. So it's part of a larger story, and it's rather depressing. We all feel left out.
Of something.
Yeah.
Eric Drown?
Actually, it's an old story. When I look at the early ham radio enthusiasts, one of the things that they were so happy with about the earliest forms of the technology was how tinkerable it was. You know, there was some mystery in trying to get sound out of a piece of crystal. But even the first tube sets had some tinkerability to them. You could build your own headset or speakers or something like that. As radios got more and more standardized, the tinkerability got reduced, and the hobby became less interesting for a lot of people, and they moved into other arenas. And I think this idea that the kinds of science that we do now are radically untinkerable, in other words, they don't fit a kind of mechanistic model of the universe that the older sciences were based on, is really part of the postmodern condition. One of the things that we feel like we have some dread about is that we can't really understand the world, and at the most sort of advanced levels of physics, you know, things break down into chaos, structured by certain simple rules, of course, but you know, undecidability and indeterminability are radically unsettling.
Wait, so are you suggesting that something like undecidability is the opposite of tinkerability? I'm being a little bit facetious, but in other words, if you have something that sort of has fixed rules, you can go in and fiddle with it because you know how things will respond.
That's right. You take it apart, and you can correct things, and you can alter it, and, you know, there's a sense that you have some power in the universe.
And that's going away.
At a certain level. And I guess that's why people continue to do things like build rockets and have rocket festivals, and why they continue to, you know, build battle bots and set them against each other, because the kinds of science that they're participating in that way, the popular science, reassures them that they have some control over the world.
All right, let's take another call. Let's talk with Steve. Hello, Steve. You're on Odyssey.
Hello, brilliant people. My question is also about specialization as a means of economic control. The amateurs being closed out, the classic example is the old story of the water engine. But I recently heard about a pair of guys who came up with a method of extracting hydrogen from water that was quicker and more efficient in their basement. It was a tiny little story, and it disappeared. I never heard anything else about it. How much control is the economic forces exercising over the scientific community?
Paul Farber, do you want to address that?
I didn't hear all the question, but it sounded like what's happening to a person who makes some discovery in his basement, and what are the economic forces that keep that from being accepted? Is that?
Well, yeah, something like that. I mean, to what extent are economic forces structuring what goes on in science?
Only in a very indirect way, I'd say, in the sense that professionals need to keep their professional distance from the amateurs in the basement. And so, and of course, they have an economic stake in that. But I don't think people are very aware of that. They don't consciously think about it. It's ingrained that the amateur isn't doing something that's valid or interesting or important, or it's unlikely.
So you mean individual scientists are not thinking about their economic security
in
doing those things that help to reinforce the line between professional
and
amateur?
Yeah, I mean, the university professor doesn't feel personally threatened by somebody tinkering the backyard.
Mm-hmm. What about Eric Drown?
I guess I would say that the sort of economic pressure on science, and particularly invention, is both more than we think and less than we think. In other words, even at the university level, much of the science is sponsored by federal government grants or corporate grants or research money being invested to produce particular kinds of results. So, you know, there is a strong economic component to even the most basic science that we're doing nowadays. And on the other hand, the basement inventor, maybe not the basement scientist, but the basement inventor, can come up with something new and sell it in the marketplace. So, to what degree economic forces sort of structure individual amateurs out of the marketplace is debatable, but in certain fields, I agree with Paul Farber, it's very, very difficult to do work as an individual. How do you do, you know, particle physics? You need an accelerator. How do you do, biochemistry or any of those kind of things?
Well, but is there another dimension here? Because not only do you need expensive equipment, but you need colleagues. I mean,
that's
the
right.
Idea that any one scientist is working entirely alone is maybe our image of science, but I don't think it's right. Eric Drown.
I agree.
Paul Farber.
Yeah, it's very hard to get the attention of the professionals. Every year, the American Association for the Advancement of Science gets proposals for sessions at their annual meeting that are basically people who are disgruntled with Einstein or quantum mechanics, I mean, relativity or quantum mechanics. And these proposals always just get thrown on the reject pile, I mean, barely read.
You're listening to Odyssey from Chicago Public Radio. Our conversation today is about amateur scientists, and their relationship with mainstream science. Let's take a call. Let's talk with Christine. Hello, Christine. You're
Hello.
On Odyssey. Hi.
Thank you very much. I had one comment and then a general question, please. I went to the University of Cambridge, the real one in England, and it's rife with science and all of that. You trip over Darwin and Isaac Newton and apples falling on your head. And my comment is, when you talk about professional and amateur, it seems to me you're making a distinction, maybe the unassumed distinction between academic and non-academic, because to talk about a professional, certainly before, let's say, the 18th century, or professional would be an academic. So it sounds like you're talking about the academic versus the unacademic, because I certainly know a lot of people who are undergraduates, and you consider them non-professionals, who are probably some of the brightest people out there, certainly a lot brighter than the quote-unquote professionals, and sometimes they become professionals, and sometimes they don't become professionals. And my question to you, my PhD actually wasn't in the sciences, but my husband's was in theoretical physics, has to do with you're using the word science instead of the word nature with a capital N. And certainly in the 18th century, when you use the word nature with a capital N, it included human nature. And certainly when Darwin used it, I do believe it was with a capital N, since he was a naturalist, capital N, not a scientist. And my question is, how do you distinguish between nature with a capital N, and do you, when you use the word science, as you do generally, do you include human nature with it, or are you saying that science does not include human nature?
Paul Farber, you
include human nature.
Paul Farber, you want to take a whack at that?
I'm having a little bit of trouble with this headphone, so I didn't quite catch it all. But actually, I didn't catch it enough to answer it.
Okay. Eric Drum?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer the question in the way it was asked, but I will give it a shot.
Okay.
For me, the concept of nature, and especially human nature, is a political construct. It's one that changes over time, and it means what it means only in the particular social setting in which it's used. So for me, when people begin to invoke the name of nature in order to explain something about the human, I'm nervous about that. So to what degree we start linking nature to science and asking science to answer questions about nature, human nature, whatever you want to call it. Again, that's what I'm calling for. I want science to be involved in that discussion, but I don't want them to be an unequal voice in that discussion. So I guess science needs to be one of many voices in that.
So,
actually, if I could just chime in.
Sure.
I mean, the discussion of human nature is almost always a matter of taking our values, reading them into nature, and then discovering them there.
Rather than finding them there.
Rather than finding them there, yeah.
We've just got a few minutes left, but I guess I'm interested in, you've both talked about this process of specialization as part of a larger set of social changes. Paul Farber, you've written about E.O. Wilson, who was sort of interested in the possibility of regeneralizing things. What is your sense of whether the gap between professional and amateur has to persist?
I think it most likely will in most areas of science. I think there are these areas like ornithology. Ecology is one area you mentioned Wilson. Wilson is calling for, he and many others are calling for a global survey of what's out there, biological diversity. That requires enormous manpower. One can well imagine many, many people being interested in the environment, being interested in nature, taking part in that. That would be very exciting, actually. But I don't see them flocking to help out with theoretical physics, but ecology may be an area.
Paul Farber is a historian of science at Oregon State University in Corvallis. He's the author of Finding Order in Nature, The Naturalist Tradition from Linnaeus to E.O. Wilson. He's also the author of Discovering Birds, The Emergence of Ornithology as a Scientific Discipline. Eric Drown, we just got about 30 seconds, but do you see the gap persisting and a persistent place in the world for amateur scientists?
Well, I do see the gap persisting, in part because the two groups we're talking about aren't talking about the same thing. And for that reason, I see the amateurs, you know, persisting precisely because they're concerned with different things that aren't being addressed through science, and they desperately want science to address them.
Eric Drown is visiting professor in the American Studies Department at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. He is at work on a book called Invention Culture, Reading Popular Science and Science Fiction in Modernist America. Eric Drown and Paul Farber, thank you both very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Thanks also to everyone for listening and for calling. Odyssey's theme music was composed and performed by OK Go. Thanks to our research assistant, Neil Verma, our intern, Maura Waltz, and our production assistant, Ragnar Anderson. Our technical producer is Steve Warinowskis. Our program is produced by Allison Cuddy, Delia Lloyd, and Becky Vlamis. The senior producer of Odyssey is Joshua Andrews. Odyssey is a production of Chicago Public Radio under general manager Tori Malatia. I'm Gretchen Helfrich. Join us again next time for Odyssey.
Funding for Odyssey is provided by a generous grant from the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, where Odyssey is produced. To listen again, visit our website, odysseyradio.org. You can find information there on how to order a copy of the show. That's odysseyradio.org.